You're listening to They Came From the North, your weekly dosage of Canadianness, Canadianosity, and movies, where we talk about filmmakers, directors, our favorites, our least favorites, and their bodies of work. I'm your host for the evening, John Mercer. With me, as always, we have, from the land of milk and honey, Mr. Andrew Forbes.
Hello.
Where is the land of milk and honey?
Anywhere past Halifax.
I thought that was Canaan.
I'm sticky and it smells bad.
From the land of smoked meat, mulled wine, and nice aged brie, Mr. Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour.
Am I pronouncing that right? Girard or Girard? Girard.
Girard. Girard. Yeah.
We only ask every episode.
or I can teach you...
Andrew, I don't want to insult the French speaker.
I can teach you how to say it the French way, but I don't know if you'll be able to manage it.
No, you just gotta start speaking a really obnoxious English accent.
In order for you to properly pronounce it, I would have to cut out your tongue.
And that, ladies and gentlemen... Back after a week off? You took a week off, you and the missus.
That was a week off?
Went off the reservation. Well, it was a week from recording this.
Well, I guess, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Went off the reservation, disappeared off into the wild, untamed wilderness of Skyrim.
Hot rumpus.
Mr. Steve Power.
It was very exciting, and tomorrow we'll go to the zoo.
You better not have watched that without me.
I didn't, don't worry.
That was the best Brian Cox impression I've ever heard. Also the first.
You're no more a king than the boil on my arse.
That was the worst Brian Cox impersonation I've ever heard.
Whatever.
I'm not even going to try.
And for those of you who haven't been paying attention, we've been teasing this for a few weeks, and we've kept putting it off. Quite frankly, this podcast is as cursed as its legendary, what do we call, subject, target, victim, victim.
A victim, a target.
Well, I didn't even understand that.
Was that Brian Cox?
No.
That's Brian Cox as played by Michael Wincott.
I thought that was Tim Curry in Legend.
We are already out of hand. Who's our subject this week?
Our subject this week is, you know, fuck it, I'm going to say legendary because he is legendary.
He is
legendary filmmaker Bloody Sam Peckinpah.
Legendary among his dealers.
Not until the late 70s. I mean, you didn't need a dealer to get whiskey.
Wasn't he coked out half the time, too?
Yeah, but that wasn't until he met James Caan.
He would actually drag his deck chair along the sidewalk into the back alley, meet up with his dealer. I assume he never got out of his deck chair.
Well, we're going to get onto his real bio now before we...
He was always a big fan of Second All.
Yeah. Born David Samuel Peckinpah in 1925 in Fresno, California. He often played truant from school during his childhood to play cowboy games such as trapping, branding, and shooting with his brother. It's believed that these days in a rural community that was just undergoing growing pains in a modern American society played an influential role in many of Peckinpah's legendary westerns. Discipline problems in high school. Discipline problems from Sam Peckinpah? Led to an enrollment in a military academy and a tour of duty with the United States Marine Corps in the tense days of repatriating Japanese soldiers following the Second World War. While he never saw wartime combat, Peckinpah was noted to have seen acts of terrible violence in situations where he and his fellow Marines were forbidden to intervene. Returning home in 1947, Sam enrolled in Fresno State College, where he met and married his first wife, Marie Selland, who introduced him to the drama department and ignited his interest in directing. In 1954, Peckinpah was hired as not only a dialogue coach, but also as an assistant to director Don Siegel for Riot and Cell Block 11. This began a lucrative period where Peckinpah worked on four of Siegel's pictures, including the legendary Invasion of the Body Snatchers, in which he actually had an on-screen cameo and has made the disputed claim of performing an extensive rewrite on the film's script. Following a period of work in television in the late 50s, including creating the TV series The Westerner, Peckinpah found himself in the director's chair for his first motion picture, 1961's The Deadly Companions. His relationship with producer Charles B. Fitzsimmons was strained at best, as the producer refused to let the young director work with star Maureen O'Hara, who was Fitzsimmons' sister. Peckinpah swore to never again direct without script control, and his first feature failed to make much of an impact. This led to 1962's Ride the High Country, about a formerly famous lawman falling on hard times, on a journey of temptation and redemption. The final role of Western legends such as John McCrae and Randolph Scott, Ride the High Country went on to win first prize at the Belgian Film Festival and landed on Time Magazine's list of that year's top 10 films, many considered to be Peckinpah's most accomplished work. In 1965, upon the recommendation of star Charlton Heston, Peckinpah was hired to direct Major Dundee, the story of a Union major commanding an outpost filled with Confederate prisoners in New Mexico. It was his first experience with a large budget and a cast of recognized faces, and unfortunately the first of many fights with the large Hollywood studios that financed his pictures. Peckinpah's descent into alcoholism began to spiral out of control, and his fiery temper led to several threatening altercations with Heston, who swore he'd run the director through on his saber if he didn't start showing some courtesy to the cast. Arriving 15 days over schedule, $1.5 million over budget, and with the director and producer no longer on speaking terms with one another, Major Dundee failed to capture a viewing audience and was venomously received by critics at the time. While hired to direct The Cincinnati Kid, Peckinpah's ambition to rework the concept and screenplay, as well as shoot in black and white, alongside some incriminating phone calls following the Major Dundee debacle, led to his firing and his subsequent falling out of favor in Hollywood for the next few years. In 1966, his fortunes changed when he was asked to write and direct the TV adaptation of Catherine Ann Porter's novel Noon Wine by producer David Melnick, who offered Peckinpah carte blanche. His screenplay was championed by the novel's author and enthusiastically trumpeted by star Jason Robards. It was considered a critical smash. Now only available for viewing at the Library of Congress, it remains the director's most elusive work. Sam Peckinpah exploded onto the Tinseltown horizon again in 1967 with the release of The Wild Bunch, a now legendary Western that's been called crude, violent, misogynistic, unrelenting, and brilliant. It was one of the first Westerns to explore the brutality of the age and ushered in a style of rapid editing that's still seen to this day. Ranked 80th on the AFI's Top 100 Movies, The Wild Bunch is considered the start of Peckinpah's rise to international credibility. Defying the reputation gained with The Wild Bunch, Peckinpah chose to follow it up in 1970 with the odd, funny, and explicitly nonviolent Ballad of Cable Hogue. His chaotic personal life and firing of 19 crew members ended his tenure with Warner Brothers and is alleged to have cost him the director's chair for both Deliverance and Jeremiah Johnson, two films that went on to great fame and fortune. Sadly, until recent years, Cable Hogue went mostly unwatched. Desperate to seize a hold of a semblance of success again, Peckinpah returned to the themes of human savagery in 1971 with Straw Dogs, one of the most prominent examples of the 70s man-pushed-too-far genre. Both damned and hailed as a darkly ugly male fantasy, Straw Dogs was nonetheless a hit and is considered by some to be one of his finest works. Next for Bloody Sam was a pair of films with a bona fide Hollywood megastar in Steve McQueen. These films, in the form of Junior Bonner and The Getaway, from a screenplay by our debut director on They Came From the North, Walter Hill. Bonner performed poorly at the box office, but The Getaway was a smash hit. In fact, it was Peckinpah's most successful film at that point. Following a hasty marriage in Mexico and a subsequent divorce 4 months later, Peckinpah's thirst for the demon in the bottle continued to play havoc with his personal and professional life, and his health grew more and more unstable in the years to come. His next two films, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, both fizzled at the box office, despite staunch support from respected members of the critical and filmmaking community. In need of another hit, Peckinpah returned to the gritty terrain he covered with The Getaway, in doing The Killer Elite, an action-filled espionage thriller starring James Caan and Robert Duvall as rival American agents. Killer Elite's probably best known as the movie where Peckinpah discovered cocaine for the first time thanks to James Caan and his entourage. At one point, he overdosed on the drug, landing himself in a hospital and receiving a second pacemaker. Still renowned in 1975, Peckinpah was offered the opportunity to direct the World War II drama Cross of Iron, which was released in 1977, based on the story of about a platoon of German soldiers in 1943 on the verge of collapse of the Crimean Peninsula. And Cross of Iron, while reportedly a favorite of Orson Welles, and is also considered one of the greatest considered to be one of the finest anti-war films ever released, it performed poorly in the U.S., probably due to the fact it was released roughly around the same time as the mega smash Star Wars. Hoping to create the elusive blockbuster, Peckinpah decided to take on the movie Convoy in 1978. Convoy, which, based on the hit song by C.W. McCall, hoping to capitalize on the late 70s CB boom and the undeniable success of Smokey and the Bandit, actually turned out to be the highest-grossing picture of Peckinpah's career, notching $46.5 million at the box office. By 1982, Sam Peckinpah's health was in poor shape, and he directed the final film of his career, The Osterman Weekend, which was released in 1983. Following that film, the last work Peckinpah had ever submitted was the two music videos for John Lennon's Son Julian. And with that, I think we'll actually get to work examining the rather prolific career of Sam Peckinpah. I'm going to start with Steve. What would you call your good?
Steve?
Sorry. Wait, microphone came unplugged.
You fell asleep during my introduction.
No, my microphone came unplugged. I apologize.
I was just thinking, you know, did John just talk for 20 minutes without being recorded?
No.
It was just the ash of last week.
I had Skype minimized. I was reading off my notes. I was like, oh, God, no.
No, my good... My original first impression was to go with the objective choice, you know, the one that pretty much everybody would probably pick. But he had at least two other films that I enjoyed more than The Wild Bunch. And in the end, it kind of came down to either Ride the High Country or Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Mm-hmm. And I chose Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I really dig The Wild Bunch. It's an amazing movie. I love it unequivocally. You know, it's a fantastic, you know, it was the first real, I guess you could say the first real postmodern Western. But Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid feels more, like more of a work from the heart. Like The Wild Bunch is just so cynical and so oppressive, I guess. So just vicious. Whereas Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid really does kind of feel like, you know, it's some of the same themes, the whole, you know, the West is changing, the West is shrinking, the old ways are starting to disappear, but it's done in a more wistfully, you know, kind of nostalgic way than The Wild Bunch is. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you had Kris Kristofferson and James Coburn, who were both absolutely freaking awesome in this movie. I love their performances. I love the music. Dylan's soundtrack is fantastic. I love the action sequences. It's got that same, you know, that slow-mo heightened punch that The Wild Bunch has. Because, I mean, it follows hot on the heels of The Wild Bunch. But it's not as dragged out and as just mean-spirited, I guess, even in terms of the violence as The Wild Bunch is. I can't really say a whole lot more than that. I mean, some people say that it's a slow movie or that it's just kind of too episodic or too, you know, like little vignettes, little character pieces and stuff. But I think it's a fantastic movie. I think it all flows pretty well. And I mean, no more so than, you know, you could call it vignettes or whatever, but it's no worse than The Wild Bunch or Major Dundee in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, To me, it's my personal favorite of his films.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't this also the debut of facial hair on James Coburn?
I don't think it was.
No, he did. I remember he had a mustache in Sideburns. I don't think he quite had the Coburn beard, though.
No, I don't think he did.
It's the first time I saw Christopherson without the beard, though.
Yeah.
I didn't recognize him at first, but I was.
First time I ever saw Kris Kristofferson not like 100 years old.
And even in his early 20s, he looked 100 years old.
Yeah, he had gray in his beard already.
Yeah.
And whiskey on his breath.
But it's definitely a very beautiful movie, I'd say. Like, I find the look to be more studied than, like, The Wild Bunch, you know? Like, it's harking back to traditional Hollywood westerns a bit more.
It feels like, other than, you know, you get those occasional bursts of violence, it almost feels more like, you know, a John Ford movie or something, you know?
It's got this very elegiac film, like, because The Wild Bunch is about the death of the West, but you really can feel it more with Pat Garrett.
Yeah,
I think.
Definitely.
Pat Garrett, it's dying of natural causes. The Wild Bunch is getting shot in the face.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. That, and I was kind of thinking something along those lines.
And I have a feeling that with both Pat Garrett and Alfredo Garcia, Peckinpah was kind of trying to go to like a purer way of filmmaking and distilling his style to the pure essential, you know?
I think, you know, after The Wild Bunch and all the acclaim, I almost think he was getting a little bit nostalgic again. You know, like, I almost think his, that whole, you know, every director has their
it's almost like he enjoyed life for
a brief flickering moment in time. It was almost like he enjoyed what he was doing, although from what I hear, the stories on set are just as tumultuous as any other Peckinpah production. I believe it was... I don't think it was Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I think it was actually Cross of Iron where he just started to pee all over a monitor while he was in the midst of filming.
Oh, dear.
I think that's a good point to move on. Gabe, what's your choice for good?
Once again, I have to go with the controversial one and choose Straw Dogs. It comes as not much of a surprise if I say that, like, if I start by saying that I'm a big Kubrick fan, and it's basically the most Kubrick-like of all of Peckinpah's film. Like, it's very controlled, and
there's not a single likable character in the entire movie.
There really isn't.
But it's so, to me, it's so masterful, and it's so, like, ambiguous that's what makes it interesting. Just the fact that it's really, like, you can see the director between the chair, you know, checking every shot, checking every editing, checking the performances. It's so, like, he's like, he's doing it more like with a scalpel, this movie, than with machine guns, you know?
Mm-hmm. I find, you know, I was kind of tempted to pick Straw Dogs as my good, but it's a movie I always get a bit skittish about praising too much because I find, you know, you mentioned sort of the ambiguity of it, and I find it's a really hard movie to read, to really figure out what Peckinpah really wanted to say. I mean, it's clear from it that there are a lot of things he hates, but... obviously there are a number of sort of uncomfortable issues that get raised in the film. Obviously it makes for an extremely interesting movie, but at the same time, you know, given the various sort of charges of misogyny that have been launched against him, there are some pretty icky spots in Straw Dogs, and sometimes I'm not sure, you know, exactly what he was trying to elicit, you know, with one scene in particular. I mean, obviously he's trying to say something about how people are inherently savage and, you know, he's got a particular idea of what a man should be and, you know, how he should fight for what's his and for survival. But there is just that sort of constant streak of ambiguity that runs through the movie and makes it a little sort of unpalatable for me. Really want to like condemn it or praise it. I just kind of want to look at it and try to figure it out, but I can never pin it down.
But I think that's what really fascinated me about it, because it's both, you know, you can see the movie progressing and like at first it's kind of quiet and taking its time, and the more it moves on, the more the cutting becomes, you know, excessive and the rhythm gets accelerated and stuff. So the pace of the movie is very much controlled, but
it's incredibly well crafted. It's undeniably fascinating.
But I think it's the contrast between that and the fact that its ideas aren't necessarily clear and that you can read into it. And I think that's something that only a great work of art can do, that you have to pause and you have to figure it out for yourself.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those movies that I can say, you know, I admire it, I appreciate it,
but you don't enjoy it.
But I can't say that I like it.
Yeah. I own it.
As Steve said once, I'm a sick man, so I enjoy it.
My thing with Straw Dogs is, you know, when I think of Sam Peckinpah, it's the last film that pops into my mind. It just...
I keep forgetting he directed it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually one of the first. It seems like almost the most distilled form of what he's about.
See, I still watch it to this day when I watch it. Like, the last time I saw it was maybe about a little less than a year ago. And even now when I watch it, it's a movie I've seen several times, and I still don't associate it with Peckinpah.
It could be. I mean, the fact that it's so... it's in many ways it's about America, but the fact that it's so un-American in its setting and obviously the whole atmosphere of the small, is it a Cornish town?
Yeah.
That it's modern day, right? I mean, he didn't do that many movies that were set in the modern day.
And the other thing, too, is with him, he usually kind of goes for a bit more of a, I won't say a distanced approach, because it's not distanced, but he likes his larger-than-life characters, and he likes his larger-than-life situations, and even, like, his filming style. He likes, you know, that John Ford style, that, you know, wide vistas and all this kind of stuff, even when he's not...
This is like a microscope on a
it's so intimate, and it's so human, a movie, that, to me, it just, like, it strikes me as completely at odds with the rest of his body of work, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just, you know, it's just an observation, you know?
I suspect that was deliberate. Well, obviously it was deliberate, but I mean, I suspect one of the reasons he probably, you know, chose to do it that way is that after doing something like The Wild Bunch, you know, where people saw it as, you know, this is the end of the West.
Yeah.
He wanted to make sure people knew that this was not about America in the Vietnam era. This was about people, you know, like this was about a household, you know, and how people relate to each other, as opposed to like a broader sort of social, political kind of
thing
statement, I guess.
And at the same time, you can see that kind of microscopic interest in something like Cable Hogue, which is really a character study before anything else, right?
And a great movie.
It's really, really great. I still love that line. What was it? He wasn't a good man, he wasn't a bad man, but Lord, he was a man.
Yeah.
and also, you can see the same kind of ideas in The Osterman Weekend, which we will probably get to later. But you can see...
Oh, yes. We'll get to that later.
You can see the same kind of home defending and the same kind of editing tactics in that movie as well.
One final observation from me on it. Not entirely curiously, but I think if memory serves me correctly, it was about the only film he ever made that wasn't completely effed by the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Straw Dogs pretty much was exactly as he intended. Like, what was released was what he shot, you know?
Yeah. Which is almost unbelievable, because, I mean, there's some very, you know, uncomfortable scenes in there.
I mean, with the fact that it had sort of the new Hollywood darling of Dustin Hoffman in it,
yeah, that
account for that.
Yeah. And Hoffman is much a director's actor. You know, he loves his directors.
And also talking about Kubrick, maybe in the wake of stuff like, I don't know, is it after or before Clockwork Orange?
I think it was before.
About the same time, before?
Clockwork Orange is 72, right?
Okay, so yeah. It would have been after. I think Straw Dogs is 73.
No, Straw Dogs is
71. Oh, 71. Okay, sorry. My bad.
But still, it's in the same era where there was kind of a more of a leeway into graphic representation, I think.
It was that whole 70s film movement kicking in.
Yeah.
Hey, one good thing came from us. You know, it gave way to stuff like Death Wish.
Yeah.
It's also got one of the all-time greatest posters
ever
devised.
That is a great poster.
I feel bad for the guy who designed the poster for the remake, actually.
Oh, God, it's awful. It's like they try to do the same thing, but then they have, like, floating heads reflected in the glass.
We can make the same poster, but with Photoshop we can make it.
I don't even want to think about the remake.
Yeah.
Are you saying that Rod Lurie isn't the director, the same sort of director as Sam Peckinpah?
There's just some slight difference. I can't quite put my finger on it, but...
And who's playing often, like James Marsden or something?
Yeah. Now, I like James Marsden.
I actually, you know what? I didn't mind the remake. It was essentially the exact same movie, only set in a different location.
I feel bad now because I just realized Rod Lurie directed The Contender. That movie was awesome.
Not the remake wasn't horrible. I mean, it wasn't as good as the original, no, but it was, on its own, it was a completely inoffensive and actually pretty gripping thriller.
Okay, well, who played...
Since it's inoffensive, it can't be the original.
Well, no, let me rephrase that.
Who played the Del Henney role, and was he half as sleazy?
He was pretty sleazy, but it was redneck sleazy.
It wasn't like My Sideburns Are Glorious sleazy.
Wasn't it? What's his face? True Blood guy?
I think so.
Son of Stellan Skarsgård.
Alexander Skarsgård, yeah.
Yeah.
I've never seen an episode of True Blood.
Neither have I. But, you know.
He was in Generation Kill.
Supermarket tabloid lineups.
Anyway.
He was Colbert in Generation Kill.
Right on. Yeah. Anywho.
So, Andrew, what's your good?
Yeah, what's your good, man?
Well, I mean, it has to be the Osterman weekend.
What? Really?
No. But I was so tempted.
Spoilers, dude. Spoilers.
We'll get into the Osterman weekend and my very strange views on it. But no, I'm going to go kind of boring and say The Wild Bunch. But I should say ahead of time that the thing with Sam Peckinpah is I haven't found a movie of his that I've completely loved.
Really?
He's the kind of guy like who I think he's an amazing director, and I think The Wild Bunch is an amazing film, but it's just every one of his movies that I've seen, there's a point in it where I check out for a little bit. And I can't even really articulate why. I think there's just... We're sort of on a different wavelength, and there's something about his, it may even be, you know, an aesthetic thing that I just don't totally.
It could be that he always has these just, what's the word I'm thinking of? These side roads that always kind of inhabit the middle act of his films.
It could be just that I'm a weak, limp-wristed liberal. Who just can't take all this manliness. it is that sort of those little digressions, I think, and especially The Wild Bunch. There's, you know,
a lot of downtime in that movie.
There is. It's odd that, you know, I choose The Wild Bunch as my good and I think it's actually probably got the most little detours of any of his movies.
Major Dundee.
Major Dundee.
Major Dundee has more.
Yeah, but...
and it doesn't have the awesomeness of the last 45 minutes of the Wild Bunch.
Exactly.
It's got an awesome last, like, 10 minutes.
The greatest slow-motion walk into absolute carnage movies have ever seen.
And, of course, it's got William Holden and Robert Ryan.
Yeah.
And Ernest Borgnine.
Ernest Borgnine's jaw.
And Edmund O'Brien and his rotten teeth.
and Warren Oates.
Oh, Warren Oates.
Hey, here's the thing. Don't you add people onto my list. Because I didn't mention Warren Oates, because one of the things I wanted to talk about
is how bad Warren Oates is.
Don't get the love for Warren Oates.
Listen, no, we'll get on to Warren Oates when I get to my bed, actually.
It could have been worse. It could have been Chill Wills.
Yeah. it's got L.Q. Jones. That guy's awesome. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know what I can say about The Wild Bunch that hasn't been said, because I'm guessing anybody who's listened to this, if they haven't seen The Wild Bunch, they've probably heard a lot about it. But all I can say is everything good you've heard about it is pretty much right on. It does drag a bit in points, but it's this great sort of, I don't want to say nihilist.
Let me correct you there. Let me correct you. It does drag a lot at some point. Not a bit. Yeah. A lot.
A lot.
Like a bag of steel holes.
But it makes up for it in a number of ways. I mean, it's, again, you know, going back to DVD case speak, I would describe it as a singular vision. which Sam Peckinpah would probably punch me in the teeth for saying that. It's just... There's no other movie like it. There's no other Western like it. And there's no other shootout like it. I mean...
Yes, there is. Extreme Prejudice.
John?
What?
Has to do two things. They have to... If there are two directors that fans of John Woo also have to check out, it's Sam Peckinpah and it's Jean-Pierre Melville. Because together they basically make John Woo. So the action comes from Peckinpah, and it largely comes from The Wild Bunch. It is a crazy, crazy collection of violent shootouts. And I actually think I prefer the opening robbery to final. It's just so controlled, and you get that sort of building tension, knowing that, you know, there are guys across the street ready to shoot the guys as soon as they come out. And then there's the, is the parade, it's the teetotalers.
Yeah.
The ladies.
The suffragette movement.
It's one of those setups where you see all of these things sort of converging, and you just know that it's going to turn out very, very badly. And it does.
My thing with The Wild Bunch, I mean, all the performances are great. And yes, I will say it really does drag in that middle act, but I really enjoyed spending time with those characters. So even though it does drag, you know, like, the characters are well established, and those actors, man, they just bleed charisma, you know? So it keeps you in there. It really keeps you rolling. And then when that final payoff hits, you know, when the let's go get 'em scene kicks in and they start the long walk, and it's just like, man, you know, some crazy stuff is about to go down. You know,
those squibs are triple loaded.
And that's why I like
William Holden and Ernest Borgnine, and didn't tell any of the Mexicans. Actually shot them.
That's why I like the end of it more than the beginning, I think, is just because it's that slow burn, it's that slow build, but it's not, you know, like, okay, in the opening when we know about it, but the actors don't, you know, the characters don't. But with this, you know, these guys are walking to hell.
The opening is about tension.
Yeah.
The ending is about them being resigned.
It's just catharsis, man. Total catharsis, you know?
One of the things I really have to talk about is the relationship between Pike, played by William Holden, and Deke Thornton, played by Robert Ryan. It's, you know, it's great to have this, you know, former, I guess, what would you call them? Brothers in arms.
Well, they were soldiers, weren't they? They were Civil War veterans or something.
And I guess, well, I mean, I guess it's kind of that old, you know, brothers on opposite sides of the law, but it doesn't feel like that in this. It's Robert Ryan has this real sense of, you know, he doesn't, I don't think he does feel like he's really doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole movie has that sort of inevitable, you know, people just going through and knowing that it's going to be awful, but they still do it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like it's epitomized in that relationship. Of Deke pursuing Pike. So, yeah, anyway, great movie.
Slow, I mean, this is also where, you know, like the typical action movie character names came from. You know, Pike,
that?
Bishop. So this is the movie, like, you know, where we started getting the like, character names you'd get, like, in the 80s action movies.
Yeah.
Pike, Bishop, Dutch Engstrom.
T.C.
T.C. I don't know where Lyle Gorch fits in.
I'm gonna say something radical here, but I haven't seen the Deadly Companions or Junior Boner, whatever. But the Wild Bunch is probably my least favorite of his western.
Have you seen Major Dundee?
I don't consider it a western.
Really?
I consider it a Civil War pick, right?
Okay. Well, Civil War picks are kind of westerns.
Yeah, but it's not about cowboys.
No, you know? Fair enough.
It's about the army.
Fair enough. More of a war film than a western.
But like, I'd take Ride the High Country or Cable Hogue or Pat Garrett, you know, before the Wild Bunch, because of that middle hand that goes kind of nowhere. You know, all I remember about it is like I saw it like what 2 or 3 days ago, and all I remember about it is like the beginning
and the end.
The train attack, and the ending, and some of the bonding between the guys.
Yeah.
I will say this as well. As for, you know, dying out of the West, late 60s action westerns, I do prefer The Professionals over The Wild Bunch.
Oh, The Professionals is an absolutely amazing movie, and it doesn't
different,
get any
very,
near
very
enough
different yet. Movie, but at the same time,
yeah,
you know, being made around the same time, you've got the same sense of, like, men on a mission.
With one of the most badass lines in Western history read out by the most badass actor in Western history.
Yeah, there is 100% less Lee Marvin in The Wild Bunch.
Well, no, because it wouldn't be The Wild Bunch. It'd be Lee Marvin stars in Lee Marvin. If he were in The Wild Bunch.
Also 100% less Claudia Cardinale.
Oh, Claudia.
If Lee Marvin were in that movie, the film would, like, transmute to steak. You can't shoot a movie on steak.
He actually turned down one of the roles. He turned down William Holden's role.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, well, it's because they couldn't handle it.
It was because he was offered a larger pay to star in Paint Your Wagon.
Oh.
Don't wanna paint your wagon.
But you know what? I kind of think it was right because as much as I love Lee Marvin, William Holden gets the sense of that weariness.
Yeah, he's really good.
He is awesome in that movie. He is probably actually.
You need it, and the thing is you needed a sort of like golden age star.
Yeah.
Past his prime. And that's what William Holden was in this. So,
whereas Marvin would be more like a force of nature.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, now that we got the Wild Bunch out of the way, I'm gonna that frees me up to take another divisive choice from a divisive director. My good is probably considered at least critically one of his more middling efforts. But I'm a huge Steve McQueen fan, so I chose The Getaway.
Nice.
Mm.
The Getaway was, I think, probably the first Peckinpah movie I ever saw, to be honest with you.
And The Getaway is, it's going to seem really weird because I chose as my good, but I'm going to be speaking negatively somewhat. The Getaway, to me, is a good movie in the same respect that Bullet is a good movie.
Steve McQueen is awesome.
Yeah, because Steve McQueen is just like pure awesome.
And the vintage 70s car, man.
Yes.
You just chose it because Walter Hill wrote the screenplay.
And because Steve McQueen slaps Ally McGrath on...
Walter Hill is my master, Andrew.
Oh, I know.
And when I'm allowed in Valhalla's, or as we call it, torchies, you'll understand. When I take my seat at my father's table.
Hmm.
I heard Steve McQueen asked to do the scene where he slaps Ally McGraw 17 times. I heard he kept asking to do more takes just to make sure that Peckinpah got it. You know.
Hey man, she wasn't much of an actress, but Ally McGraw was gorgeous in this movie.
She was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I think, understating it. Yeah. She was not an actress at all.
Or understating that she's gorgeous.
She cannot act.
No. Oh, so cool. But thankfully, most of the scenes she was in, the McQueen charisma train was like pumping enough diesel to get her through.
Ally McGraw just always looks like a mouth breather trying to work out a really hard math problem.
The way her brow furrows.
Getaway was what? What year was The Getaway?
72.
What year was Sugarland Express?
74,
I think, because they're kind of similar movies. Sugarland Express is almost like, you know, a G-rated
Except
version.
One of them is happy, and the other one is one of the most violent movies ever filmed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're very similar.
At least the Sugarland Express hasn't had a remake that totally sucked.
It also had Dick Thornburg. Or Dick Thornburg.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress.
I just realized there have been two remakes of Sam Peckinpah movies starring James Woods.
Really?
Yeah, he was in Straw Dogs and he was in The Getaway.
I didn't realize he was in Straw Dogs for some reason. Yeah.
Coach.
Yeah. Duh. Anyway, that's how much James Woods stands out to me.
I love James Woods.
But... Videodrome, man.
Exactly.
Long live the new flesh.
And I totally forgot Slim Pickens was in The Getaway.
Are we going to talk about this movie, or are we just going to browse the IMDb page?
Dude, you think I actually watched anything this week? I've been playing Darksiders.
Wikipedia.org. Yeah.
And you only had 1 week to prepare for the Sam Peckinpah.
So, yeah, speaking about The Getaway, the opening scene show Carter Doc McQueen in the Texas.
Man, Avrex.
No, I just think it's, you know, I don't know. It probably was also the first Peckinpah movie I ever saw before I ever knew who Sam Peckinpah was.
Yeah, I doubt I knew who he was when I saw it.
But it's just, it's phenomenally badass, you know. It's got that great 70s score by Quincy Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I think my thing with The Getaway and why, I remember liking The Getaway, and I've seen it a few times, but I find it for some reason really dry.
You want to talk about a movie that drags in the middle?
Yeah, and also. it felt like they didn't really do a whole lot of, polish. You know,
here's the thing with the Getaway. It's entirely populated by Stoics, except for Al Lettieri and Sally Struthers.
Oh God! Don't even bring up Sally Struthers.
Why would you do that?
All these people not fucking looking cool,
and then Sally Struthers.
Fucking veterinarian out of my mind. I thought the entire movie was Doc McCoy getting out of prison, robbing someplace, and then shooting someone. Actually, it's a very dirty, sweaty 1970s crime movie.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the movie it reminds me the most of is actually the original Thomas Crown Affair.
Really?
Just in that, you know, I don't mean to be really mean or anything, but in that empty, vapid 70s action flick with Steve McQueen, right?
Yeah, and that was, I think, my thing. It feels like it's a rough edit, and it feels like, you know, there was very little Foley work done. It was just kind of, you know, it wasn't like watching an Andy Sedaris movie, because Peckinpah is just so much better than Andy Sedaris. But it didn't have that polish.
When we do the Andy Sedaris episode, I'm going to make you weep. Because all three of my choices are going to be her ticket to Hawaii.
No! All three of mine will probably be Malibu Express. Savage Beach.
I just can't. I like The Getaway, but I hate Ally McGraw in it.
Andrew, your blind hatred of Michael Douglas' portrayal of Nick Conklin has nothing to do with this movie.
You're right, for once. So there's the Ally McGraw factor. And then there's the just awful, awful side plot of Al Lettieri going and, like, kidnapping the vet and Sally Struthers. And first of all, I mean, the idea of Sally Struthers being attracted to Al Lettieri is absurd because, I mean, the man just looked like a giant nostril.
I forgot he was Sollozzo in The Godfather. The picture literally just loaded up on the thing as you said, giant nostril. And that's honestly what it looks like is descending out of that white hat.
Yeah. And it's just, it's awful. Like, it feels mean-spirited and, like, everyone, all three actors in that sequence are irritating. And then they're just driving, and then they start throwing chicken wings at each other. And, oh, I just, I hate it. And it just completely derails the movie.
So is this your bad, would you say?
What's that?
Is this your bad, would you say?
I didn't want to come out and say that yet. Which is a shame because I find all the stuff with, you know, McQueen setting up the robbery and that going wrong. And then, you know, him, you know, his showdown with Ben Johnson and then, you know, the various things they encounter as they try to get away. I think that's really good. But there's just this dead, annoying weight.
Yeah. It's a 2-hour movie that could have easily had 25 to 30 minutes sliced out.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why it reminds me of the Thomas Crown Affair as well.
Also, the Slim Pickens thing at the end feels like it comes out of nowhere.
Well, they needed a happy ending, man. It's called The Getaway. He can't go back to prison.
Yeah, but I still wish they were getting away while riding a nuke.
And that in would... Diola, I think it's kind of forgettable, too. It's not... I didn't think there was anything special about it.
It did just feel like a lot of, like...
I hate you guys. This is my last episode of this podcast. Enough of this. On to our bed. Are we just going to let Andrew segue?
Segue, Andrew, segue.
Yeah, The Getaway. Everything I just said. Gabe?
Gabe, you're bad.
My bad is Cross of Iron. It's a very interesting movie. Probably one of the few movies about World War II made by an American to focus on the German sides of things. And it's got some really interesting things to show, especially that most of the soldiers in that movie, they're not Nazis. They're just soldiers. Like, there's even a conversation with the two antagonists. They hate each other, but they both hate the Führer as well. I think there's some really cool action sequence, some great acting, but in the whole, it's a mess. There's too many digressions. The action scenes, although some are really great, some are cut way too fast, even feeling almost modern. I don't want to sound too mean, but almost like Michael Bay-ish. Like, it's chaos. You can't tell what's going on.
That's kind of the influence of Cross of Iron, though. that's the thing. He kind of... Like Peckinpah, and I know guys like Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, when they first really broke out, Peckinpah was always cited as one of their really big influences. And I know Tarantino was a huge fan of Cross of Iron. So it's kind of, you know, it's one of those... Yeah, it was influential, but was it necessarily a good thing that it was influential?
Not really, because it's really one of those movies that makes you sad that it's so much a mess, because you can see the beauty under it, you know? Mm-hmm. There's some really great scenes, as I said. There's one point, like, basically the whole battalion leaves and leaves the Coburn's outfit behind to get attacked by the Russians. So there's that great scene when they, like, you only see the tanks advancing in the total silence, and they're coming out and they're freaking out. And Coburn's really, really, really great in this movie, of course. And I think James Mason, too.
James Mason, who is in another of the rare Hollywood movies that sort of depicted World War II from the German perspective, because he was in The Desert Fox, wasn't he, as Rommel?
He was, yep.
Yeah.
Awesome movie. Awesome flick, too.
Great movie. Mm-hmm. And, we've also got to bring up the loathsome Private Zoll. And his exit from the film.
That was pretty harsh.
Yeah, that was...
Unworthy, but deserving.
Yeah, you know, fuck him, he's a Nazi. You know, if he didn't go out that way, he'd have to look into the Ark of the Covenant, right? That's the only way that irritating little shit deserved to go out.
My bed was also Cross of Iron, but not entirely for the same reasons. I was right with the movie. I wasn't a big fan of the whole, like, the little hospital side road. That didn't really need to be there. But for the most part, I really enjoyed the film. But what ruins it for me is the fact that the movie doesn't end. It just stops. It doesn't end. It stops. And what happened there was they were on the last day of shooting. And apparently, from what I understand, one of the ADs or one of the assistants or something was trying to stop the producer's goons from coming down and shutting down the power as Coburn and the guy who played Stransky,
Maximilian Schell.
Yeah, Schell and Peckinpah were filming the last scene. They were basically filming the ending and scrambling to get it in the can before they came.
Maybe that's what the poster is about then, you know? It's a face-down guy just reaching for the Iron Cross and he almost gets there.
That's Peckinpah just trying to finish the movie.
But he's tangled up in the studio's barbed wire.
In the barbed wire of Eastern European porn producers who
really,
found cash to make
it. Really, that's his entire career right there.
And all he's wishing for is Steve McQueen to jump over on that motorcycle.
Yeah.
And just snatch that Cross of Iron.
But, I mean, that was the thing. At this point in time, Peckinpah had a lot of trouble in Hollywood. No studio was giving him money to make a movie. It was done, like, entirely on...
Especially not a World War II movie from the perspective of the fucking Germans.
Yeah, exactly. It was all done from, like, Eastern European money, and I think the main, like, the head producer was actually a guy who made porn movies.
Hello?
You know? So...
Wolfgang C. Hartwig, a German film producer.
He was part of Odessa, and he thought it was going to be like a new propaganda flick. And then when he found out it wasn't, he was like, what? Shut
down. Was ist das?
I did like the part when they fall into the Russian women, you know, the soldiers. That's a nice part. But I have to mention an especially irritating earworm to someone who's familiar with German. And the main commander is called Steiner.
Oh, okay.
And they keep switching between calling him Steiner or Steiner. It's Steiner! Say it the right way or don't say. I'm like, why? Like, in the same sentence, some guy calls him Steiner. And then says Steiner. I'm like, decide, please.
If only they could have forced themselves through sheer will, it would have been a real triumph.
If only they could have done more than one or two takes of a scene because they were so crunched for time. But I mean, you know, like to me it was, and it was building up to something really cool, you know, like come Major Steiner, I'll show you where the Iron Crosses grow, you know, and I'm like,
Steiner.
But you know, like I was expecting then, you know, like, another one of the long walks, like something out of the Wild Bunch, you know, but then it just ends. The movie's over. You're just like, oh.
That's funny. It's funny. That
if only they played the credits really fast against Yakety Sax. That would have been the cherry on top.
It's funny that you mentioned the Wild Bunch because they both end with, like, people laughing.
Yeah. Yep.
Which doesn't make sense for Cross of Iron, but does for the Wild Bunch.
Okay, so I'm guessing that was, Steve, you said that was your bad as
that
well?
That was my bad as well. I mean, like I said, I love it, and that's, you know, of course, always been the stipulation of our bad, a flawed movie that we still enjoy. So.
Yeah, it's a very fun movie.
All right, getting on to my bad. Bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia.
No, I don't want
to. Fuck Warren Oates.
I thought he was badass in that movie.
I kind of liked him in it too, to be honest with you.
No, man, but he feels like just like that manufactured badass.
Kind of like Michael Biehn.
Yeah.
Or Bill Paxton.
No, listen, everything that comes out of Bill Paxton is natural.
I don't know about that. Did you hear about this one that they're making? I think it's coming out this year, called Bring Me the Head of Lance Henriksen.
All right. So beyond fuck Warren Oates, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I just found it was just mean. Just really, really, really mean. Like, I do not know who pissed in Sam's cornflakes when he was making this
movie. Do you know why the movie was so mean?
Is this right after he got divorced?
Well, there was a divorce in there, yeah.
Ebert wrote a really good piece on this, and it had to do with him visiting. I think he was visiting on the set of Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia to do an interview, and that'll give you some insight into Sam's state of mind at the time.
It actually was the only movie he ever directed that he had complete final cut on.
Yeah?
Yeah. So, he was a mean prick.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, look, because I've read stories about the making of it, and it's like he's descending down, like, the Colonel Kurtz road of madness. Like, they're going further and further into the shitty parts of Mexico.
Yeah.
To film this movie. And it's like, at some points I'm watching, I'm like, this is a goddamn masterpiece. Mm. And at other points, like, why does it feel like I'm getting kicked in the balls while I'm watching this? It's not like the Wild Bunch, where it's just, you know, pure, like, manly hoorah chest-beating violence. This movie is just dirty and mean. It's like, you know, that first time you went downtown with your friends and stayed out till 3 a.m. and couldn't get the cab ride home, and you see how ugly the world really is. That's what bring me the head.
Which, and in that sense, it was the right choice to choose Warren Oates as the lead, because he basically looks like a guy whose pawn shop just went under,
yeah.
And you know, they just found a bunch of child pornography on his computer, and this is
basically.
He looks like a really scuzzy guy.
And I mean, that's why it's
he looks bad. Like he
it's
totally
not,
looks
not,
a good
it's
diddler.
Not like ugly, you know, like. I remember renting this from the old Allen's Video just when I saw the cover of the movie, which was just awesomeness, right? Just the fist clutching the locket. But yeah, it was one of Peckinpah's few, especially for that era, modern day films, right? But just.
Mm-hmm. Just, but it still feels like a Western.
It does. It really does.
And it's also, you know, I'm going to use the thing Cameron said about aliens. You know, it feels like 20 miles of bad road.
Yeah.
Right? It's just,
it's the movie where you can see most clearly some Peckinpah's id, you know? It's like it came out right of his unconscious, basically.
Did he have anything other than an id?
I don't think so.
No.
He's just the raging id monster from Forbidden Planet.
And it's like...
They just put sunglasses on him.
If you want to talk about influence, this is the movie I feel that might have influenced Takeshi Kitano the most.
Well, it's one of Kitano's favorite movies, actually.
It is.
And you can see it.
And one thing I always loved about it is the last, very last shot of the movie, which kind of sums up Peckinpah for me. The close-up of a smoking gun barrel. It's just, I don't know,
this
man.
This is the man who kept a loaded .45 under his desk while editing.
Like, I mean, it's just, It's mean. It's nasty. I said sweaty earlier for The Getaway, and this is even sweatier. You know, there's machete kills in it, right? Just nasty, bloody, mean spirited, and probably brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is.
It is brilliant.
Now let's get on to the real reason we came here tonight.
Uh-oh.
The Ugly. This is this is probably our favorite and least favorite part of every episode.
I really hope we've all picked the same one.
It's why we all end up drinking heavily after every recording.
Oh, I'm already drinking heavily now. Jesus, guys, I've been drinking since I started writing the intro 3 weeks ago.
Just to get headspace. Into his, yeah.
Did we all pick the same movie for our Ugly?
Okay, well, I'll count to three, then we all say what we picked, okay?
Okay.
Ready? All right. One, two, three.
Convoy.
I know, I picked Convoy.
You bastard.
Every time I looked at the Osman weekend, I was like, this movie's a goddamn mess, and I just remembered the VHS cover. I was like, oh.
The movie, the Osman weekend, no, it doesn't really
work. It's great, it just doesn't make any goddamn sense.
It doesn't say the same thing
about The Expendables.
It's the greatest thing about it, because it's the greatest, paranoia movie ever, in my opinion. And the fact that it makes no sense whatsoever is perfect for it.
It doesn't work the same way Basic doesn't.
When I was watching The Osterman Weekend, it's Sam Peckinpah does David Cronenberg or David Lynch, right?
Hey, those two are not equivalent. We decided that.
They're both named David. They're both weirdos, and they both filmed in the 80s.
Yes, hey, what were you saying, Gabe? Gabe, huh?
I was going to say that The Osterman Weekend is the worst film that Alan J. Pakula never directed.
But now let's get back on to Convoy.
I just want to say, the only real unforgivable flaw of the Osterman Weekend, in my opinion, is that when those hitmen shoot at them, the bullets always go in neat little straight lines along tree branches when they miss. It's and the tree branch falls off.
The presence of TV's coach negates that.
He's amazing in that movie.
It has the same...
Coach, Rucker Hauer, and John Hurt in a movie.
Yeah.
Go rent it right now.
And
download it, pirate it, buy it, whatever the fuck you got to do.
John Hurt is amazing in that movie. He's the scariest character ever devised. And the sequence where he just suddenly pretends to be the weatherman because he can't turn off the monitor is genius.
It has the same problem that Basic has, the whole overarching plot.
No. But Basic is ooh, I'm twisty. Check me out. I'm super, super controlled narrative that happens to not make sense. The Osterman Weekend is just the world is crazy.
Zippity dippity dop dip dibble dop. I just snorted a 5.5 line. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
And then the RV blows up.
It's as if Johnny Five from Short Circuit read the Ludlum novel in his 5 seconds and then wrote the script on coke.
Then summarized.
Okay, back on the Convoy.
Convoy.
Let's just start off with get some basic knowledge out there. Smokey and the Bandit, this movie is not.
This movie's not even Cannonball Run.
No.
I mean, when you base a movie on a shitty song.
Yeah,
the big old Convoy Cross.
Don't start.
Confession. Don't make me think about Renee Zellweger.
Confession here, I couldn't stomach more than 10 minutes of Convoy.
Gabe, that's all I could stomach more than 10 seconds of Convoy. I tried to watch it on Netflix. I was like, this looks awful. And that's enough justification for me to stop it.
But to appreciate its awfulness, you have to watch it.
I used to own it on DVD.
Well, that is a confession.
Yeah. Just because it was a Sam Peckinpah movie. That was the only reason I owned it.
Did we give that one the Suspiria Office Space treatment?
No, I gave that one the holy shit, I'm trading this in as quickly as I can treatment.
Okay.
So yeah, Convoy, you've got Kris Kristofferson looking at his absolute coolest. He's like ripped and he's like cool, but he's some kind of truck driver act. I don't even know where to start. So we've got truck drivers who, and we've got Ernest Borgnine playing a motiveless psycho cop who just hates truckers for some reason.
He's the same guy as what was the guy from First Blood, you know? Maybe a truck.
Brian Dennehy.
Yeah, like Brian Dennehy's character from First Blood.
Only
Kris Kristofferson doesn't give him a war he'll never forget. a war he won't believe.
Ernest Borgnine has no motivation. He's just like, I just hate you. And then they get into some kind of like jolly good old boy bar fight, which maybe people died in. I don't know. But it was like simultaneously like, ha ha, rednecks having fun. And also like pointless violence. And then they all jump in their trucks and go on a convoy because that's what the song was about. And I don't even.
It's like, I didn't want to watch more because I'm like, it was making me sad. I couldn't like realize that this guy made this bad of a movie.
And it was clearly trying to get in on the like, sort of like,
CB grades,
social upheaval protest kind of thing, like 10 years too late, with absolutely no explanation about what any of it was about. And it made no sense. There's no reason for any of these people to be following him.
Well, they're part of a convoy.
Dude, he's got a great big convoy.
But man, I mean, just those, that opening scene is awful. That's all I saw. Like him following the girl with like no panties on and getting arrested by the cop, and you can almost hear the Benny Hill song in the back.
See, Gabe, that's like one level of badness, but then it gets to a whole other level because the last half of the movie is just like them desperately trying to wring as much pathos out of it as they possibly can.
Isn't the last part of the movie like a big Alamo? Just a big fight?
No, the last part of the movie is, spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't want to have Convoy ruined, is basically Kristofferson like driving across this bridge into certain
death. Yeah.
Because,
but it's not as poignant as Vanishing Point.
No.
No, and getting shot to hell, and then there's,
And then you turn it off, you get a new book of matches to pick your teeth with, and you go watch Smokey and the Bandit.
Yes.
Here's a good way to put it. Burt Young has been in both Convoy and another Peckinpah movie, Killer Elite. In Killer Elite, he throws a ninja off a boat.
And we're talking about Uncle Polly here?
In Killer Elite.
Ugh. I can't believe
I'm gonna use the word sweaty again in this podcast, but you mentioned Burt Young.
it's like you can see him crash. Even if you weren't there, you can see Sam Peckinpah crash and burn during his last few movies.
He must have been Convoy for a paycheck, and he must have just been like shaking his head.
He was actually out of commission for most of Convoy. Convoy was actually mostly directed, or about half and half, depending on who you ask, by James Coburn.
Yeah, I can see that.
Isn't that wacky?
Yes.
Oh, he and Kris Kristofferson went drinking after every take.
Here's what I'm thinking. He would be directing it, and he'd be directing this like jolly, like sort of cross-country caper movie. And then every time Sam Peckinpah sobered up, he'd come in here and he'd be like, "Let's make everybody sad."
Was that Michael Wincott in the role of Sam Peckinpah?
Let's make everybody sad.
It may have been.
John Hurt came in and said, "Let's make everyone sad
before I make you miserable."
But Kristofferson did have a kingly beard in that movie.
Oh, did he ever? The beard he was missing as Billy the Kid.
It's like, I don't think Kris Kristofferson ever looked cooler than he did in Convoy. The least cool movie ever made. Which is just goes to show how cool Kris Kristofferson is.
And the original poster is awesome. Absolutely fantastic.
Is that the one where Ally McGraw has her like arms around him and he's just like, yeah.
He's got no shirt on and it's all painted.
Yeah. Ain't nothing gonna get in their way.
It looks like something that'd be airbrushed on the like a GMC wide body van in 1979.
Oh, but they got in their own way when they made this movie.
I'm adding that to my cyberpunk tattoo.
Well, I'd also like to add that the only there are two black actors in this movie, but one of them is called Black Widow. Hey, you doing, Black Widow? I'm still a widow.
And I'm black.
Like, yeah, progressive.
You guys just made me really, really uncomfortable. And with that, we're going to start to clue it up. I'm going to ask you guys what you think of Sam Peckinpah. Any final thoughts?
My final thoughts on Sam Peckinpah. I love him. I think he's a really talented guy. I think he had a gift. I think he had a wonderful eye. His shot compositions, like all the technical aspects of his films, really well executed for the most part. But I think he was just, you know, like so many other, you know, quote-unquote brilliant artists, he was just so hamstrung by his own flaws, by his own need to just constantly be intoxicated. And then, of course, by the ever-popular studio interference that...
Who didn't want their director constantly intoxicated.
Yeah, well, you know, understandably so. But, yeah. I mean, the thing is, obviously the guy, and I think, you know, his proclivities, his let's call it his extracurricular activities, I don't think really hurt his performance in making films. Like, I don't think the fact that he was an alcoholic or a drug user hurt The Wild Bunch or Cross of Iron or, you know, Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid. Like, I think most of his movies, that doesn't really come into play. I think what it hurt was his ability to stay on budget and on time, and that's what hurt.
His clout.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, like, because of his troubles, it took him longer to put something together, and that's...
Working with producers who were really excited because they were going to be working with Sam Peckinpah, and then they realized they were working with Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Be careful what you wish for, you know? But I think the man, in particular with the Western, I think as far as... You know, directors go, he really is, you know, Hollywood's last great Western director. He really, you know, and like a lot of those 60s and 70s Westerns, man, were just amazing, amazing movies. And
Walter Hill,
yeah. I mean, what has Walter Hill really done that equates to, say, you know, The Wild Bunch or Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid or Ride the High Country, you know? I love my Walter Hill. I love him, but, you know.
My thoughts on Peckinpah, actually, I think he, and I'm sorry for jumping in, Andrew and Gabe, I'm going to be a selfish bastard, but...
I'm shocked.
You don't sound shocked at all. You're a worse actor than Ally McGraw.
I'm just being the passive Frenchman, as usual.
Steiner!
Somebody's got
it. Yeah. Steiner! I think... Sam Peckinpah came along 10 years too early. I think if Peckinpah had been turning out like his Ride the High Country and Major Dundee and everything in the 70s, this guy would have fallen in with the whole Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg school of filmmakers.
I think he really
was an eye ahead of his time.
I think the problem with that line of thinking with Peckinpah is that kind of short shifts the influence that he had on that generation. Like, I mean,
The Wild Bunch almost gave birth to that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying is Peckinpah's, like, the way he edited his movies and the way he shot his movies, he was the transition between,
between the
Howard Hawks and the John Ford and the old Hollywood blockbusters.
David Lean.
He was the step in between, yeah, David Lean and Steven Spielberg.
But I think without him being where he was, I don't think it would have evolved quite the way it did.
No.
I was wondering about that. When did Leone start making his Westerns?
Leone started in the early 60s.
Okay, I think they were first released in the U.S. in 66.
I think it was when The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was made. I think it was when the other two were. push out ahead of it.
But, I mean, you also had guys like, what's-his-face, who did Bonnie and Clyde
Arthur Hill.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, Peckinpah, my final thoughts may be a bit confused, but that's fine, because his probably
worst... Because it's Peckinpah.
he's a guy that I respect enormously for what he contributed. And I kind of wish I loved his movies when I just like them. Like, obviously, their movies, I think there are some people who can't get Kubrick in the same way. Like, he just feels cold to them, and they don't see him. And I feel like Peckinpah is a guy where I just don't operate on the same wavelength, despite the fact that sort of from a removed perspective, I appreciate a lot about his
movies. Just because you're too much of a girly man.
If there were chest vaginas in his pictures,
he's all over it.
You haven't drunk enough whiskey in your time.
I guess.
Take that umbrella out of your beverage, sir.
That's it, Andrew. I'm bringing Ally McGraw over to your house, and you can slap her 17 times.
Leave her hand.
You got it all out of your system? No, I think I need another take.
bring me my chocotini.
Oh God!
So should I?
Quick! Gabe, your thoughts.
Yeah, I'll say that his reputation as the violent, as the bloody Sam Peckinpah, I think it often undercuts some of his talents. For I mean, a lot of his characters are very three-dimensional and very interesting. And I think there's much more going on under his films than just the simple violence. And even qualifying something as products, just qualifying it as misogynistic is stupid to me, because it's so much more complex than that.
I'd just like to sort of jump on that point too, even though, sorry to interrupt. But yeah, I mean, he's so much more about darkness than about just violence.
And the other side of it, he actually, when he wants to be, he can be a very warm filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean,
no, he has his tenderness.
Look at Cable Hogue, which I'm kind of disappointed we really didn't get to talk much about.
Great movie. Well,
on the Cable Hogue is probably his underrated, most underrated movie to me. I really, really loved it. And I loved Ride the High Country, but that's more highly regarded than Cable Hogue is.
And if you've seen Ride the High Country, you don't really have to worry about The Dangerous Companions, because that was basically like, or Deadly Companions was basically a dry run for Ride the High Country. It was essentially the same story.
But yeah, for me, I wasn't really familiar with him before. I'd only seen The Wild Bunch and The Getaway before getting into this. And, I mean, I really liked most of his movies, but after a point, it was like getting me down, right?
Yeah.
I was like, he's getting me depressed here.
It's a very emotionally deadening experience.
But
I got addicted to uppers while watching it.
I think with all the praise around, you know, his action scene and how he cuts his shootings and stuff, people forget how good he was at photographing vistas and just plain visual filmmaking, you know?
Well,
and,
all around, technically, he was amazing.
And you know, that the action, I mean, when it's easy for us to look at something like The Wild Bunch now or Peck Garrett and Billy the Kid and see the slow motion, like the really, you know, punctuated violence through slow motion and stuff like this, and it's easy for us to dismiss it, but, you know, when he did it, it wasn't done before, you know?
Well, the one that really put my jaw on the floor was the shootout at the end of the Ride the High Country.
Yeah.
I thought that was especially masterful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, like, these kind of action sequences didn't exist before, you know, before Peckinpah, really, you know? Like even with Leone was all about the slow build-up and then the sudden explosion of violence, you know, like the sudden fast whip cut of... like one gunshot and it's over, you know?
Of the same sound effect six times. Six guys fall down.
Yeah, exactly. But like with Peckinpah,
laser pistols.
With Peckinpah, he really did kind of turn violence. Like he was the first to really turn it into a ballet, you know?
And this really makes me want to do John Woo.
I do want to somewhat retract what I said. I kind of gave the impression that I was saying that John Woo hasn't done anything to add to what Peckinpah did. I will say that John Woo has his whole, like, this whole, like, timing sense and combination of regular motion and slow motion that is...
And doves.
A whole different thing. So,
John Woo is the very best of Sam Peckinpah's eye and Sergio Leone's tin ear.
God damn it, who keeps knocking on that wooden door?
Yeah, Sam.
All right, so stay tuned. Next week we're going to discuss another manly man, and that is Mr. John Carpenter.
So until then, sit tight, keep the home fires burning, and if we're not back by dawn...
Call the president.